Will you denounce anti-Semitism once and for all, just to clear up the confusion?
Why is there any confusion about that? Really?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Yeah, really?
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Nope, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and Radio Sputnik, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell-ish fellow from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up, this appears to be it. This appears to be what Trump has been warning us about, what Trump has been threatening us about, and what a great deal of people in this country apparently voted for when they voted in favor of Donald Trump to become the president of the United States. On Tuesday, the Trump administration has issued guidance memos on immigration enforcement regarding the undocumented in this country, on children who came here years ago and have known no other country, no other home but this one. Rules for law enforcement that may open up the door to mass deportation. We'll be joined by Wendy Feliz from the American Immigration Council shortly to unpack what all of this means and to find out if it is as disturbing as it sounds. But hey, Desi Doyen, she'll join us with the Green News Report a little bit later. Those are always fun.
Oh, these days, don't you know?
So that's coming up as well. You know, you're supposed to be our...
I'm supposed to be bringing the good news, but I, like I said, we're always looking for the good news wherever we can find it.
Yeah, we'll see if we find any today. Well, let's start here with this, because really this is the only good news that I've been able to find here today. Donald Trump seems to have selected a national security advisor to take the place of what? Fired?
Michael Flynn.
I know. Was he fired? Was he resigned? Michael Flynn, who had been his national security advisor. So the new pick for the national security advisor seems as if he is not insane, as far as I can tell. So that's
such a low bar.
Yeah, right. But that seems, that's about all I can come up with. That seems like a good thing that he is not insane. And actually, it's a very important role, national security advisor. And having Michael Flynn there, who I think is absolutely insane, having him gone, I think, is a good thing. And having someone who is not insane in his place is also a good thing. H.R. McMaster, an active duty Army general. He will be President Donald Trump's next national security advisor after Flynn stepped down after just 24 days. McMaster is well known among observers of the U.S. military. He has a sterling reputation as a strategist, as a leader, and intellectual, according to Zach Beauchamp over at Vox. Fred Kaplan at Slate reports that McMaster is widely viewed as the Army's smartest officer. That's a good thing, too. His predecessor, Michael Flynn, had a seemingly justified reputation for being a loose cannon who attracted fringe political ideas. But McMaster, Beauchamp reports, is the opposite. He is a careful scholar and a successful general who's well-regarded in Washington foreign policy establishment circles. So even some Trump critics, like former Obama Defense Department official Andrew Exum, have praised the selection of McMaster. Exum said, "He is one of the most talented men I know, a great officer and thinker. Huge upgrade."
Okay,
that's
then.
Good.
Yeah. It's a shame we had to go through all of this to get to the guy who might actually be qualified.
And there are still questions about how much McMaster will actually be able to do in this role, and will he be able to face down potential opponents in the Donald Trump's inner circle. But just a little bit more background here on McMaster. He enrolled in a history the PhD program back after serving in the first Gulf War. In 1997, he published his dissertation dissertation in a book arguing that the incompetence of and internal divisions among the country's leading military officers during the Vietnam War allowed President Lyndon Johnson at the time and his civilian advisors to get trapped in an unwinnable war. That seems like it may be a useful observation, a useful understanding. In 2005, then Colonel McMaster was deployed to Iraq and was tasked with pacifying the city, the insurgent-ridden city of Tal Afar. But unlike many of George W. Bush's generals at the time, McMaster had emphasized Arabic language skills and interfacing with the Iraqi civilians at the time, on the theory that insurgents cannot survive in a friendly population, population that was friendly at the time to the U.S. forces there. Foreign Policy's Tom Ricks described McMaster's time in Iraq like this. He writes, I remember him telling his soldiers that understanding counterinsurgency really wasn't hard. Every time you disrespect an Iraqi, you're working for the enemy, he said. That sounds good. That sounds encouraging. I'm glad to hear that that man will be the national security advisor. Ricks went on to say that under McMaster's policy there, they even had customer satisfaction forms, literally. Detainees were asked to fill out upon release with questions like, were you treated well? How was the food? What could we do better? That sounds outrageously reasonable. So I am, let's say, delighted that H.R. McMaster is now being appointed as the National Security Advisor. He will not have to go through any sort of confirmation process, as the NSA does not have to do that. That's just a selection of the presidents. And by the way, Ricks had reported that that approach in Iraq worked very well, and he was able to establish control over the city with cooperation from local authorities by the end of the year after he had been assigned there. So that's good. Zach Beauchamp says it's hard to think of a man who's more qualified, at least on paper, but he will have to get past these this question about staffing. And that was one of the folks who turned down the job from that was offered to him by Donald Trump, General Harwood. Harwood said he wouldn't do it because he did not want to keep Michael Flynn's top deputy on, KT McFarland, a Fox News advisor. He didn't want to keep her on. So the question is, did McMaster agree to keep McFarland on? We're supposed to be looking to see if she resigns in the next few days. That will be an indication of whether he agreed to work with her. Fred Kaplan over at Slate notes the key thing to know about McMaster is that he has made a career of speaking truth to power, often instinctively without the slightest talent for fawning to his superiors. But as a military man speaking to the president of the United States, there's a question of whether he was able to tell that president that, no, I need to have this deputy or that deputy. I need to staff this up with my own people. So that lies ahead, and there endeth good news. Sorry, because in what has now become an almost weekly occurrence, a fourth wave of bomb threats appears to have been made against Jewish community centers across the country this week, forcing evacuations once again. According to various reports, Jewish community centers in Birmingham, Alabama, Houston, Texas, St. Paul, Minnesota, Whitefish Bay, Wisconsin, Buffalo, New York, Chicago, Illinois, Albuquerque, New Mexico, Tampa, Florida, Nashville, Tennessee, all received threats on Monday. Jack Jenkins of Think Progress reports this is at least the fourth wave of bomb threats targeting American Jewish community centers since January. Prior to Monday, roughly 48 Jewish centers in 26 different states had reported receiving unsettling phone calls this year from a caller using a voice disguiser in what is being described as telephone terrorism. None of the incidents, fortunately, have uncovered actual bombs or resulted in physical harm. But these fear-based attacks are rattling many in the Jewish community, understandably so. There has been a sharp uptick in anti-Semitic incidents across the country that began during Donald Trump's campaign, for president. They appear to have escalated since his election. Think Progress tracked 70 instances of anti-Jewish hatred since Trump's election. And while evidence indicates that hate incidents are skyrocketing generally, the largest number of incidents, according to Think Progress, have been anti-Semitic. In a separate count of hate crimes, the Southern Poverty Law Center reports nearly 2,000 incidents in the 34 days after the November election, both anti-Semitic and other bias-related harassment. On Monday, Matt Ferner at HuffPost reported that the far right has become emboldened under Donald Trump, and while the number of Americans who directly support hardened hate groups remains far lower than it had been in earlier decades, the number of hate groups in America is rising. According to Southern Poverty Law Center, Heidi Byrick, director of the Intelligence Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center, said that this series of bomb threats since the new year is unprecedented. She says she's been at SPLC since 1999 and has never seen a string of attacks like this that are targeting the same kind of institutions in the same kind of way. This is new, Byrick said. Now, this comes as Donald Trump has been asked three times last week by multiple reporters to comment on the rise of anti-Semitism in press conferences, but he declined each time. He ignored a question about it last week during a press conference with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He discussed the margin of victory in his election instead. And when he was asked explicitly by one Jewish reporter the following day to comment on the rash of Jewish community center bomb threats, Trump interrupted him, said his question was very insulting, told him to sit down without even finishing his question. Meanwhile, vandals in the St. Louis area have caused extensive damage to a Jewish cemetery in University City. Some 200 headstones at the Chesed Shel Emeth Cemetery.
In University City, Missouri.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, I said the St. Louis area. That's right. And okay, because I'm from there, I thought everybody, but you're right. In University City, Missouri, 200 headstones at Chesed Shel Emeth Cemetery discovered to have been toppled, among other damage and desecration. According to police, cemetery employees discovered the damage on Monday morning. The cemetery was established by a group of Jewish immigrants from Russia in 1893. It has been around a very long time. Numerous plots were damaged. Headstones were pushed over. The police declined to comment on the possibility of the vandalism being a hate crime. Right now, everything is under investigation, they said. We're looking into all possible leads. We don't know. This could just be some crazy kids having fun in the cemetery. Police are reviewing the security camera footage as they can find it from the cemetery and surrounding businesses. Missouri Governor Eric Greitens denounced the vandalism as a despicable act. He said anyone who should seek to divide us through an act of desecration will find instead that they unite us in a shared determination. From their pitiful act of ugliness, we can emerge even more powerful in our faith. According to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Congresswoman, or State Rep, I should say, Stacey Newman, who has family members buried in the cemetery, stood along with State Rep Joe Adams, a University City Democrat, whose district includes that cemetery, to say, "This desecration has devastated the whole St. Louis community. The grief and sadness of this act is overwhelming, completely overwhelming." Now, on a personal note, as I mentioned there, I'm from St. Louis. My grandparents are buried at the Chesed Shel Emeth Cemetery. So, this is somewhat disturbing, somewhat overwhelming. Just by way of full disclosure, yes, I have a dog in this particular hunt. It was particularly disturbing when we got off air yesterday and saw the news of this. I don't know if my relatives' graves have been disturbed. But yes, very disturbing on a number of levels. In a statement to NBC Peter Alexander on NBC's Peter Alexander on Monday, the White House press secretary had, speaking of the threats against the Jewish Community Center, said those threats were unacceptable, but had made no reference to anti-Semitism. For some reason, the White House has been having a very difficult time talking about anti-Semitism. They did not mention the Jewish people specifically on Holocaust Remembrance Day a week or two ago. Finally, on Tuesday, Donald Trump specifically denounced anti-Semitism. He denounced the recent rise in bomb threats against the Jewish community centers around the country. He said that anti-Semitism and racism that continue to trouble America must be addressed. NBC's Craig Melvin questioned Trump and was finally able to get an answer from him on the matter directly.
Will you denounce anti-Semitism once and for all, just to clear up the confusion?
Well, I do all the time. I do all the time. And I think it's terrible. I think it's horrible. Whether it's anti-Semitism or racism or anything you want to think about having to do with the divide, anti-Semitism is likewise. It's just terrible. And you don't know where it's coming from, but I certainly hope they catch the people. I think you maybe have had it for longer than people think, and maybe it gets brought up a little bit more, but I will tell you that anti-Semitism is horrible, and it's going to stop, and it has to stop.
So you're denouncing now once and for all?
Oh, of course, and I do it wherever I get a chance, I do it.
Well, it took him long enough. On Tuesday, Hillary Clinton, before Trump made his statement, remember Hillary Clinton? Remember that woman?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she tweeted out, Jewish Community Center threats, cemetery desecration, and online attacks are so troubling, and they need to be stopped. Everyone must speak out, starting with the President of the United States. Well, he finally did, at least to an extent. This was during his tour of the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Trump was shown an exhibit on slavery during the American Revolution. He was joined by two black members of his team, of course, Housing and Urban Development Secretary nominee Ben Carson, and incredibly enough, administration official Omarosa Manigault, which is just incredibly enough for anyone who has ever watched The Apprentice and knows who this woman Omarosa is. The museum includes an exhibit about Ben Carson and his beginnings in Detroit, his rise as a neurosurgeon, and then eventually as a Republican presidential candidate. Trump later told reporters that he plans to visit the Holocaust Museum, and he said, quote, "That's very important to me." Speaking after the tour of the museum, Trump pledged to fight bigotry, intolerance, and hatred, and he thanked states where he won by, quote, double digits. Yes, he's still talking about his election. During his impromptu speech, he then went on to address the anti-Semitic threats once again made against the Jewish community centers.
This tour was a meaningful reminder of why we have to fight bigotry, intolerance, and hatred in all of its very ugly forms. The anti-Semitic threats targeting our Jewish community and community centers are horrible and are painful and a very sad reminder of the work that still must be done to root out hate and prejudice and evil.
The Anne Frank Center for Mutual Respect called those statements denouncing anti-Semitism from Donald Trump, quote, a pathetic asterisk of condescension. He said the president's sudden acknowledgement is a Band-Aid on the cancer of anti-Semitism that has infected his own administration. According to a statement they posted on Facebook, the Anne Frank Center said his state is a pathetic asterisk of condescension after weeks in which he and his staff have committed grotesque acts and omissions reflecting anti-Semitism, yet day after day have refused to apologize and correct the record. The Anne Frank Center is the New York-based partner of the Amsterdam-based Anne Frank House, where Anne Frank was hit out and was eventually found and taken away and killed in a concentration camp. The Anne Frank Center describes itself as a civil and human rights organization. They said in their statement, make no mistake, the anti-Semitism coming out of this administration is the worst we have seen from any administration. The White House repeatedly refused to mention Jews in its Holocaust remembrance and had the audacity to take offense when the world pointed out the ramifications of Holocaust denial. And it was only on Monday, President's Day, They write that the Jewish community centers across the nation received bomb threats and the president said absolutely nothing. When President Trump responds to anti-Semitism proactively and in real time and without pleas and pressure, that's when we'll be able to say this president has turned a corner. This is not that moment, the group said. So, well, where does all this come from? Why, you know, why would all of a sudden there be all of these incidents of anti-Semitism? Where could that possibly come from? Who could have possibly sent that kind of message while they were running for president? Was it the person, who also talked about shipping away millions of undocumented aliens, undocumented immigrants in this country? Because hate crimes are on the rise, not just against Jews, but also Muslims, also Mexicans, Hispanics. And I don't know that they're going to get any better, at least based on the documents that were issued on Tuesday by the White House concerning undocumented immigrants and their plans to enforce the law in that regard. We're going to talk about that next with someone from the American Immigration Council. I'm Brad Friedman. This is the Bradcast. Hey, it's Brad, and you're listening to the Bradcast on Radio Sputnik. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Boy, it's one of those days. It's getting disturbing out here. New York Times reports the Department of Homeland Security on Tuesday released a set of documents translating President Trump's executive orders on immigration and border security into policy, bringing a major shift in the way the agency enforces the nation's immigration laws. Under the Obama administration, undocumented immigrants convicted of serious crimes were the priority for removal. But now, however, immigration agents, customs officers, and Border Patrol agents have been directed to remove anyone convicted of any criminal offense. That includes people convicted of fraud in any official matter before a government agency, people who have abused any program related to receipt of public benefits, etc. The policy also calls for an expansion of expedited removals, allowing Border Patrol and Immigrations and Customs Enforcement Agents, ICE, to deport people more immediately. Joining us now to understand the details of what is being released by the administration is Wendy Feliz. She's the communications director at the American Immigration Council, and she joins us at the last minute here. Wendy Feliz, thank you for joining the Bradcast today.
Happy to be here, Brad. Thank you.
I guess let's start broad here. What exactly is spelled out in these new memos from DHS? Specifically, as I understand it, it's the sort of the reinterpretation of our immigration laws that presidents of the United States are allowed to do?
That's right, Brad. The president actually does have a lot of discretion when it comes to immigration law. And what we have here that was released, which were the final versions of these memos that were previously leaked, that are essentially tied to the executive orders that the president discussed on January 25th. So these are the memos that sort of put his ideas on interior enforcement and border enforcement into action. And they're sort of our worst fears realized, quite frankly. I think one of the sort of, well, there's several things that are very stark and very punitive about this, but I think one of the things you talked about earlier is going after people with criminal convictions. This goes even further than that. It actually tells ICE to prioritize people even suspected or even charged with a crime. So the concept of guilty, you know, innocent until proven guilty goes out the window. So even if you're suspected of committing a crime, you could be subject to deportation. So it's broader than is almost imaginable. And essentially what they've done is do away with all the priority enforcement memos that were written under the Obama administration, whereby they were trying to narrow down who was deportable. And that's just basic law enforcement 101, the idea that if you go after jaywalkers with the same force that you go after bank robbers, then you're not really doing a good job of stopping people that really pose a real threat to society, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what the Obama administration's enforcement memos were attempting to do, was to really prioritize, knowing that you have a finite number of resources, knowing that Congress only allocates about enough funding to deport 400,000 people a year. Who do you go after when there's 11 million people as well as people arriving at the border? So what the Obama administration attempted to do was just be smarter about how they use those law enforcement resources, and what the Trump administration has done with this piece is just take that off the table and say, you know, a jaywalker and a bank robber, so to speak, are at the same level of danger and should be removed. And so it's basically going to put, you know, just a lot of people at risk for deportation, and it casts a very wide net. And you also mentioned the piece about expedited removal, mm-hmm. which was a way that we remove people without giving them any due process. And it's something that's been very active at the border for many years, but it was limited to generally newcomers who were arriving, and they would go through this expedited process. Now what they're suggesting is that would go to across the country, and they haven't put anything in the Federal Register yet, so we're not totally sure of what it's going to look like. Mm-hmm. But it could be as broad as anybody in the interior country who's been here for 2 years or less could be subject to this very rapid deportation process. And so those are just two of the things that we find just very, very upsetting and very troubling, and are going to really change the face of enforcement.
And when we talk, and we hear a lot of people talking, we use this phrase, you know, oh, you know, if they're caught for jaywalking, they could be deported. In looking at these memos, is that quite literally the case? I know they don't spell out jaywalking, but is it quite literally the case that anything as quote-unquote criminal as jaywalking could be applied as an excuse for detention and deportation?
You could be suspected of doing something wrong. You don't even have to be convicted of doing something wrong. They could suspect you were in a gang because you have a tattoo. They can suspect that you are, you know, in this country illegally and ask you for documents. So it casts this incredibly wide net, so that basically anybody can be caught up into it. And so many people that go through proceedings or that get detained don't have lawyers. So they're being out-navigated by government lawyers in a system that is geared to deport them. It's not a system geared towards figuring out, do you have equities? Do you have U.S. citizen kids? Do you have a family member that could sponsor you? They're not looking for that. They're looking for ways to remove people very quickly. And the vast majority of people never have an attorney. So it's really important anyone, whoever gets detained, gets legal representation and gets legal advice, because they're very efficient at sort of getting people in the deportation process and removing them. And there's these extra ways that they're criminalizing. They're even discussing ways to criminalize parents of children who arrive. So like children that might arrive at the U.S. border who have a parent who's in this country, they're mm-hmm. going to try to find ways to criminalize those parents and say that somehow they're responsible for, you know, if they finance the child's trip here, or if they can prove there's any kind of involvement of criminal gangs and transporting the children, they want to charge the parents with criminal offenses. So it's just generally this trend that's been going on for a long time, but it's finding ways to criminalize the immigrant population. So then you can say, it's not that immigrants are more criminal, they're actually less criminal than the native-born, and studies have borne that out for 20 years. But it's finding ways to criminalize them so we can say, see, they're dangerous, they're criminals, we should deport them.
Now, Wendy, you say the parents of these kids who show up here, you're saying if the kids show up, they're undocumented, but the parents are here legally with a green card or even citizens?
No,
they could be?
I mean, we don't know the exact, like, right. Features of it, mm-hmm. but it's basically the kids who are coming in as unaccompanied children who show up, and then what happens is when you come to the border all by yourself as a child, you're handed over not to ICE, you're supposed to be handed over to Health and Human Services, and then there's law in place that says basically Health and Human Services need to reunite you with a family member. So that person might be an aunt or an uncle or a parent. Well, they're going to look to see if they can prove that somehow that kid showed up here through the help of, you know, coyotes, basically, is what they're called, and a lot of people know them as. And if somehow they can prove that the parent had something to do with paying the coyote to bring the child here or to secure their safe passage, they'll give them a criminal conviction. So this is very new territory. that has not ever happened. So that's one piece we're looking at to figure out. And then the other, like, sort of incredibly massive expansion is this idea that everyone that, that ICE comes into contact that is suspected of either being illegal or have committed a crime would be put in detention. So you're talking about the massive expansion of detention space, which obviously is going to be a boon to private prison industries, but yep. they're going to need to detain, you know, far more people than they detain now. There's a 34,000 bed mandate now. We're talking about a much larger number if you have to detain everybody while you figure out what you're going to do with them.
This is our worst fears realized, as you describe, Wendy Feliz. The it also seems, as disturbing as it is, it also, am I wrong to say here that this seems like just bad policy? As far as, you know, when you mentioned 11 million immigrants in the country that we've allocated funding currently, Congress has allocated funding to, you know, to be able to detain and deport about 400,000. Law enforcement needs those priorities to know who to go after. And while I hate to help out law enforcement in this particular case, as I hear you describe it, it sounds like this is confusing for law enforcement that they now don't have a direction or priorities of who to go after first, where to focus their own limited resources. Is that am I right on that? I mean, it just seems like bad policy in that regard.
It is, and I think you're absolutely right, and I think that's why you've seen so many local law enforcement agencies over the past couple of years say we don't want to cooperate with law enforcement, with immigration enforcement, because basically we're at the local level trying to solve crime. We have limited resources. We need to build community trust so we can solve crime and so that people will report crime, and we don't want to be seen as an immigration enforcement agency. And so they wanted immigration enforcement, the feds, to do that and let them do their local law enforcement. This new executive order and the new memos that followed are basically saying they want more cooperation with locals. Local law enforcement doesn't want to cooperate, not because they don't believe in enforcing the law, but they have a separate mandate from immigration enforcement. And so they're conflating the two. And so what's going to happen when someone wants to show up and report a crime, but they're undocumented? They're not going to do it, because then they're afraid that's going to trigger their deportation. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't make anybody safer. It makes us less safe, in fact. And it puts additional mandates on local law enforcement who continually claim that they don't have the resources to even do the work that they've already mandated to do. So it's not smart policy. And I think a lot of people don't understand, all these law enforcement databases talk to each other. So even if you're a sanctuary city, it's mm-hmm. not to say that your database is not speaking to a federal database when somebody is charged with a crime or someone is arrested. Those databases do communicate. What local law enforcement is saying, it's not saying they're not going to cooperate and help them, you know, catch bad guys. They're just saying we're not going to take our street cops and start them, you know, on the path of doing deportations. We have other things we have to do locally to keep our community safe. So it's terrible policy. And I think that's why it's not been the practice, because we've kind of come far along on it. And unfortunately, these new memos really kind of unravel a lot of the thoughtful practices that went into setting priorities, letting local law enforcement do their job, letting federal law enforcement go after bad guys. It's kind of rolling that all back and saying, hey, it's a free-for-all. Go get them. You know, that's going to drive people further underground. It's going to strike fear in communities. It's going to hurt economies. It's not good policy.
Does anything in these memos, as you read them, I know that ICE agency could call on local enforcement to help, but is there anything here that, as you read it in any event, that requires them to do so? Because then we get into this, it's a legal issue, and I don't know if you know, you're able to speak to it, but now you've got the federal government versus these so-called sanctuary cities, and, you know, is there anything that requires these local police at this time, as you read these new documents, that would require them to do things they do not wish to do?
Well, that's sort of in the, so we're going back to the days of 287G agreements.
Mm-hmm.
And we had moved away from 287G agreements and this program called Secure Communities, and they had gone to something called Priority Enforcement memos. And now these are lots of acronyms and lots of program words. But basically what they want to do is, rather than have localities say, this is the way in which we feel that it makes sense for us to work with the federal government to identify serious threats, but this is how we do our law enforcement here, so there's not a one-size-fits-all. So they're rolling that back, and they just want basically everybody to cooperate. And they want to be able to deputize local law enforcement to do deportations. And so are they going to try to cram that down localities' throats? Absolutely. And they've already said they're going to look at ways where, if you won't cooperate any certain county or state, they will look for ways to ding you. They will look for ways to hold federal funding back. Now, they haven't actually proposed exactly what that will look like, but I suspect that's going to be ripe for many kinds of challenges, because localities don't want the federal government to tell them, you know, how they do their law enforcement. So I think they're going to attempt that, they're going to attempt to force cooperation, but I think that so many states and mayors and others have been very vocal that they're not interested in being told how to do law enforcement locally. So I think you're going to see that. That's going to be a growing conflict. I mean, all of this is going to be a conflict. You're going to see increasing numbers of churches taking people in. You're going to see disrupted families. You're going to see disrupted communities. You're going to see impacts to local economies. This is going to be very disruptive and potentially disastrous to the economy.
This just sounds like the absolute worst nightmare. We talked last week on the show about this this woman who has been here for decades. I think she's got kids in Phoenix. She's been deported now because her crime included using a fake social security number so that she could work in this country and essentially pay taxes that she would never get back because she was an undocumented immigrant. So it's even that sort of crime, right? Giving a fake social security number that you plant, that you use to pay taxes. That right. You'll never get back. That's enough to throw you out. Essentially, it sounds like 11 million people are now good to go. The Trump administration is ready to throw out anybody for any reason if they are not documented.
Yeah, and I think the example of the young DACA recipient in Seattle, Washington, who was somebody who had, you know, been given this form of protection from the government, he had a work permit, and they're basically saying he shouldn't have that anymore because he's suspected of being a gang member because he has a tattoo. And so it's like, it really is starting to feel like even people we said we would protect, like Dreamers, are not necessarily protected if we arbitrarily decide we think you might be in a gang or we might think you've done something else illegal. I mean, to say that someone that's either suspected of a crime or charged with a crime is then by definition a criminal, that's a scary arbitrary line that this administration is saying, you know, sort of it's what they want to color it on any given day. And that I think makes everybody feel in the immigrant community, even the documented, I think feel very targeted, very insecure, and people who know and live and care about immigrants feel that wave too. So it just seems like just incredible fear-mongering. And
and we're talking about, in the case of DACA, the Dreamers, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, the case you mentioned up in Seattle, which we've covered. There was a guy who two different approvals from the federal government, from the DACA work permit, and yet he has still been arrested. He was rounded up when the officials came to arrest his father for some reason or another. They took him as well, and he's now been in been detained for about 2 weeks.
Yeah.
How many people are we talking about? How many kids are we talking about? Or at least, I don't mean kids necessarily, but people who came here as children who actually gave their information, their name, their address, everything else to the federal government under the DACA program, received a proper federal work permit, that those people could now also be deported for really no reason at all.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a lot of fear in the DACA community. There's about 740,000 kids who have received that, you know, that work permit through that initiative. And I think it is scary because what that Washington case demonstrates is, you know, they're okay with picking up collaterals, you know. So they're going to say, no, we're just going after the bad guys who overstayed their visa or who had a final order of deportation. We're just going after those guys. But, hey, if their kids are there, we're going to grab them, too. And if they've got DACA, we'll find a way around that. We'll say, oh, they're probably in a gang or whatever. I mean, it's so incredibly scary and arbitrary, and they're going to coerce people into signing documents, and so it's just so important that people don't say anything or agree to anything until they get legal counsel, because it's a sophisticated and complicated legal system, and they really need to make sure that their rights are protected.
And that's, I've got just a minute or two left here, Wendy Feliz of the American Immigration Council. You mentioned several times that people need to contact attorneys. Do you have advice or steps for those who are in danger from this order? What should they do? Who should they contact? These are not necessarily people who have, you know, lawyers on a, you know, on standby. How should they move forward at this point?
Right. Well, I think what's really important is you can find, there's lots of sort of pro bono projects that are popping up for people that can't afford services. So there's like Catholic Legal Immigration Services, there's United We Dream, who actually have a program that they're putting together to provide pro bono legal services. And then people, you know, in each state, there's organizations state by state that try to work with migrants and help immigrants find pro bono legal assistance or low-cost legal assistance. There's also the American Immigration Lawyers Association that has 14,000 lawyers who, you know, do lots of work on sliding scales and whatnot. So there's definitely legal services available. You have to do a little sort of Googling and research, but there's an increasing number of lawyers who really do want to provide that assistance to people. So I think you're going to continue to see like low-cost and no-cost things popping up. I think it's really important people get Know Your Rights trainings. You don't have to open the door when ICE is pounding on it, particularly if they don't have a warrant. And if they do arrest you, people need to know that they don't have to say anything. They shouldn't, you know, give them any more information about their status than until they talk to a lawyer. They shouldn't admit to anything. You know, it's the basic things you would advise anybody when they were arrested is basically wait to talk to a lawyer.
This is so disturbing. The part of this, I understand, may rely on Mexico to allow the U.S. to return folks who came, not necessarily not Mexican citizens, but who came from Central America and so forth. Any reason to believe that Mexico would actually cooperate with this policy? And do you expect, Wendy, to see just all kinds of legal challenges at this point filed against it, as we saw after the executive order concerning immigrants from Muslim countries last week or two?
Well, on the first piece, I think Mexico has a lot coming at them from the United States and from this president about what he thinks they should and shouldn't do. So I think we kind of have to, I'm not going to speak on behalf of what Mexico may or may not be willing to do. I think we'll have to wait and see. I think there's a lot, you know, renegotiation of NAFTA, paying for the wall, and now, you know, repatriating Mexicans and hanging on to Central Americans. It just, you know, it sounds like we're putting a lot of policy down, and they need some time to react. So I think we'll have to wait to see how they react. On the second piece,
the legal challenges.
There's a lot of pieces to these memos, but I would say that, you know, and a lot of time when you file litigation, you have to wait for harm, right? You have to actually say, hey, somebody got hurt by this policy, and then that person comes forward as a plaintiff. So I think you have to kind of wait for some of these policies to start to be implemented, and then you see where people are actually harmed, and then I think you'll see lawsuits propping up all over the place. I keep saying this really corny joke, but I don't think he's making America great again. I think he's making America litigate again, because there's just going to be nonstop litigation on all these issues and all kinds of other issues. There'll be lots to say about that in the coming weeks and months.
It's a jobs program for attorneys and apparently for 10,000 law enforcement agents that they say they're going to now have to hire to enforce all of this. What a nightmare. Wendy Feliz, thank you so much for joining us and for the work that you guys do at the American Immigration Council. We will be shouting in your direction again soon, I suspect, as this unwinds and gets worse and worse. You can check out the American Immigration Council at AmericanImmigrationCouncil.org and on the Twitters at IMMCouncil. Wendy, thank you again, and put us on your press release and list, and good luck as all of this moves forward.
Absolutely. Thanks for unpacking it for your audience.
You bet. Lots to unpack, unfortunately, and the unpacking will continue. We got to take a quick break here, and Green News Report, Desi Doyen. That's always cheery. That's coming up next. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away. Hey, this is Brad, and you're listening to the Bradcast on Radio Sputnik. Yep. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Desi Doyen and the Green News Report coming up. I keep hearing those words, Des, from
words?
Wendy Feliz, our worst fears realized.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of what we're looking at with a lot of things with the Trump administration, especially when it comes to the environment.
Should we rename the Green News Report the Our Worst Fears Realized Report?
Oh, yeah, that's a real showstopper.
Will that be catchy? Will that get folks to tune in? All right, well, let's get to it. The worst fears continue in our latest Green News Report.
At the end of the day, this is about protecting public health. It's the Environmental Protection Agency.
What to expect for the EPA following the rushed confirmation of EPA enemy Scott Pruitt.
We've learned he was airlifted from the scene just minutes after he caught fire this morning.
Three fossil fuel explosions in 2 weeks. Alaska officials say they can't shut off leaking natural gas pipeline. Plus, the Midwest sets a U.S. wind energy record.
All of that breaking wind news and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
The new head of the EPA is completely in the tank with the oil and the coal. That's how Republicans work. With Donald Trump. While you're watching the clown screw the pony, they're breaking into your car.
Yep. This is your Green News Report.
Just remember that.
Okay, Desi Doyen, boy, the U.S. Senate was really in a hurry to confirm Scott Pruitt to head the EPA, weren't they?
Yep.
The ayes are 52, the nays are 46. The nomination is confirmed.
And now it's a rough road ahead for the Environmental Protection Agency and the future health and safety of all American citizens now that the U.S. Senate has confirmed Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt to head the Environmental Protection Agency. For the record, Susan Collins of Maine was the sole Republican to vote against Pruitt. Two Democrats voted with the Republicans, Joe Manchin of the coal state of West Virginia and Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota. Both are up for re-election in 2018. Senate Republicans rushed the vote despite a federal judge's ruling the day before for Pruitt's office to release emails he exchanged with oil industry executives while serving as Oklahoma's attorney general, emails that Pruitt had withheld for 2 years.
And if they're anything like the ones we saw before, that he simply copied and pasted from oil executives and sent to the White House, there could be a lot of disturbing stuff in those emails.
But it won't have any effect on his confirmation.
Yes, God forbid we should wait to know who we're actually confirming first.
The Washington Post quotes anonymous administration sources saying that within the next few weeks, President Trump will issue executive orders to roll back President Obama's climate and water rules and lift a moratorium on federal coal leasing. Pruitt said his priority will be to withdraw both Obama's landmark Clean Power Plan that limits carbon emissions from the nation's power plants and the Waters of the United States rule that would have reduced industrial and farm waste dumping into the nation's drinking water supply.
So who exactly is the Environmental Protection Agency now protecting?
Good question. Congressional Republicans have pledged to help Trump and Pruitt slash the EPA's budget. In an interview with PBS NewsHour, Jeremy Simons of the Environmental Defense Fund said such draconian cuts could severely damage the EPA's core mission of protecting public health.
I mean, we're talking about gutting core capacities like enforcement, like science, the health studies that need to happen to make sure that pollution is controlled. So we're worried about enforcement, like what he did in Oklahoma. We're worried about interfering with science.
Frankly, the the EPA may be a victim of its own success in cleaning up the air and water. Most Americans don't know just how awful pollution was in the United States before the EPA was established by Republican President Richard Nixon in 1970. Rivers were on fire from industrial waste, raw sewage in drinking water supplies, air pollution as bad as Beijing, China's is today. Meanwhile, over just the last 2 weeks, three new major fossil fuel explosions in the United States. In Louisiana, one worker was killed in a natural gas pipeline explosion on February 9th that also injured two other workers. It took nearly 5 days to extinguish that fire, with no cause yet determined. In Texas, an explosion from a natural gas pipeline on Wednesday near Corpus Christi shook homes 60 miles away. No injuries were reported. The very next day in Oklahoma, an oil-fueled worker was airlifted to hospital with severe burns after an oil well head exploded and ignited three other wells. The cause for that explosion is also under investigation.
Is that Scott Pruitt's Oklahoma?
It certainly is. Meanwhile, in Alaska, no explosion yet, but fishing boats have been ordered to stay far away to avoid sparking one from an offshore natural gas pipeline that's been leaking for nearly 2 weeks in Alaska's Cook Inlet, impacting the feeding grounds of the endangered Cook Inlet beluga whale. Sea ice is preventing divers from reaching the pipeline to shut it down. Finally, wind energy set a new record in the United States. On February 12th, wind energy provided the majority of electricity for 14 states served by the regional electric power grid, which runs power lines from North Dakota to Texas. For the first time ever in the United States, wind supplied 52% of that grid's electricity reliably without any issues.
No wind explosions?
Nope.
No wind spills?
Nope.
Well, then, let's keep building more oil pipelines. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. My thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help Desi and I celebrate our 8th anniversary of the Green News Report as we head into a very uncertain 9th year. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
It may be. Thank you, Desi. There's some good news there. 52%. A majority in those 14 states coming from wind energy. Yes, it can be done. It's not a boutique energy anymore. Wind,
right.
Solar. So there's some good news. I got some other good news that is just coming across the wire here, but you had a point or two you wanted to catch real quickly concerning Scott Pruitt.
Yes. You know, remember his big goal is to get rid of the Clean Power Plan. That's mm-hmm. that crucial tool that we're supposed to be using to meet our commitments under the UN Paris Agreement to cut our emissions.
Crucial, said Barack Obama.
Exactly.
But yeah.
And pretty much anybody else who understands the electric system and global climate emissions and all that. But so for Pruitt to withdraw the Clean Power Plan, the Washington Post in that story is reporting that Trump is going to frame that order to rewrite the Clean Power Plan carbon rules for existing power plants as a means of reducing U.S. dependence on other countries for energy. That's the claim that they're going to go for. Oh, we won't have to import energy from other countries quite as much. But that's a head fake, because in reality, the U.S. power sector does not really import that much fuel for electricity generation.
Not anymore.
And actually, oil was never really used for electricity generation.
Right.
It was all homegrown coal and now homegrown natural gas.
Yeah.
So when they say, oh, we're going to have to do this because we don't want to import energy, they're not really telling you the truth. So that's a purposely misleading.
But do they have to tell us the truth? Do they have to give a reason, as far as you know, to just do away with the Clean Power Plan?
I think that they have to give a reason for the media so that they don't get attacked so much. But no, they could do whatever they want.
Legally,
without having
they don't have to go to court.
Yeah,
right.
It will take some time and it will, but they are definitely gunning for the Clean Power Plan. And just one last thing, the Audubon Society, you know, the bird people, they're usually not very political at all. They reacted to Pruitt's confirmation by saying, quote, he's a menace to himself and everything else in the air. Yes, birds too.
Wow. Yeah. That's the Audubon Society?
That was the Audubon Society.
Yeah.
Not pulling any punches on that
well,
one.
Well, and we will see how much of a menace he is. I don't think we can even understand yet how bad this could get. But with that bad news, let me give you a little bit of good news that came in across the wire, so I haven't gotten to read much more of this. I'll just read you the first sentence of this report. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit
has ruled that the Second Amendment does not protect assault weapons. An extraordinary decision, keenly attuned to the brutal havoc these firearms can wreak, according to Mark Joseph Stern over at Slate, issued by the court sitting on bank. That means the entire court, essentially. Tuesday's decision reversed a previous ruling in which a three-panel panel of judges had struck down Maryland's ban on assault weapons and detachable large-capacity magazines. Today's ruling is a remarkable victory for gun safety advocates and a serious setback for gun proponents who believe the Second Amendment exempts weapons of war from regulation. I suspect we may have more on that tomorrow and in the future, but there's some good news to close out the day. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my guest today, Wendy Feliz of the American Immigration Council, and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, you can download it for free anytime at bradblog.com or your favorite podcast site, like iTunes, where we hope you'll stop by and leave us a good review, make it a little easier for everyone else in the world to find us as well. You can drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com, and you can and should find, follow, and share us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at The Brad Blog. All right, that's it. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.